I've told people I'm not into counting calories, but if there's one thing that you should count, count your fiber and really try to get those 10 grams per meal. Try to get 30 grams a day. Sometimes people can go even higher, and it's not something that needs to be consistent every day. You might have a lower fiber day or a higher fiber day, but I do believe in the context of gut health, brain health, and mental health, that that is one of the more important levers that gets overlooked.
From the calorie model to eliminating added sugar and ultra-processed foods, there is a lot of advice when it comes to nutrition strategies for mental health. But we know that when you pull back and talk personalized nutrition, it's really not that simple. In part two of our conversation, I'm back with Dr. David Wyss to explore some misconceptions about certain foods and their impact on mental health. We're challenging some long-held beliefs about calorie counting and ultra-processed foods, especially for those recovering from disordered eating or trauma. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by mixed messages around food or wondered how to support mental well-being through nutrition, this episode's for you. Before we jump in, I want to address something that will come up in our conversation today: the evolving science of ultra-processed foods and their connection to mental health. A new review in the BMJ looked at 14 meta-analyses, meaning studies that are based on multiple studies themselves, and found that diets high in ultra-processed foods are associated with a greater risk of mental health disorders, including depression. Ultra-processed foods are packaged products made mostly from extracted or synthetic ingredients, often with additives like artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives. They're highly industrialized, ready to eat, and typically high in added sugar, salt, and fat. This research reinforces what many dietitians have long suspected, that what we eat isn't just impacting our physical health, but also our emotional well-being. And while this might be true, I know the conversation has to be more nuanced, and I think there's some confusion around what we consider ultra-processed. So stay tuned as I ask Dr. Wyss for his take and we get to the bottom of this connection. There is a lot of chatter out there and a lot of opinions, but you're the perfect person to bring the facts. So there's something that you're very passionate about, and I am, which is the calorie model. And to define it really quickly, it's this weight loss or gain is calories in versus calories out. You just burn or consume more than your body needs to lose or gain weight. So if you want to lose weight, just eat less. What do you think?
I was indoctrinated into that way of thinking when I was in school. And I knew very early on that it was a highly incomplete and misleading model. Fast forward 15 years later, it still seems like it is the kind of popular paradigm. And that's because people like hard science and like math. And with technology, you can get a lot of data on calories. So people tend to focus on it as the top of the top. And I guess if I were to push back on the calorie model, I would push back on it because of my interest in mental health. It really reduces nutrition to being solely a vanity-focused endeavor. And if someone is a believer in the calorie model, they might choose a lower calorie version of something that is nowhere near as nutritious as the higher calorie version. So it just lands on me as diet, culture, energy, but there's a lot of mechanisms in terms of gut bacteria, hormones, even digestive disorders that challenge this calorie model as a whole. And I think people are coming around to say there's more to it, but if you look on social media, especially in the fitness world, it tends to be sort of the thing that people double click on the most.
I think you're right. It doesn't account for your age, your muscle mass, your fat mass, the fact that you're in menopause, your hormones, the past dieting, where your metabolism's at now. Just so many things that also are influencing calories out and calories in. If you eat less calories, your metabolism taps the brakes and starts to slow. That doesn't match the calories in versus calories out model very well at all.
I introduce people to don't count your calories, count your blessings. Let's look at the different food group distribution and count your colors. Let's try to get all the colors of the rainbow. Certain calorie calculating apps and softwares do try to account for all these other factors, but there's so much more to nutrition than body fat manipulation and weight management. And that's probably why I don't love the calorie model. It's not going to be the thing that's going to move them into the new chapter.
100%. And I don't want to imply that calories don't matter at all. How do you talk to people about calories?
I don't offer it as a framework because it does seem that if someone is focused on that, they might miss all the other parts of the picture. It's like buying a car based on you really like the tires. So it's not like I would tell someone to ignore it. I would just focus on filling in the missing gaps.
So I really want to learn from you about how we approach ultra-processed foods. And that might be additives, colors, fillers, and how that overlaps with mental health conditions.
I know we touched on it in our first episode, and it's just worth diving back in because there's a lot of research and a lot of headlines and a lot of controversy. Some of the pushback that I hear is that ultra-processed foods aren't very well defined. And they actually are. So a lot of times when people are saying there's nothing wrong with ultra-processed foods, they're talking about processed foods, foods that contain identifiable food groups that have been enhanced for palatability. Most of the food we eat is processed foods. When we talk about ultra-processed foods, we really are talking about foods that are made by a series of large-scale industrial practices that involve a lot of manipulation of the food and a lot of exposure to metals and heat and plastic. And so a lot of the issues with ultra-processed foods don't just come from the ingredients themselves, but from the loss of nutrients that occur during processing. And the other part that I really want to emphasize is most people, when they think of ultra-processed foods and these sort of current efforts to quote unquote demonize them, they go to immediately cookies, cakes, snacks, etc. But ultra-processed foods also includes all these predatory diet foods, keto breads and the no-sugar Jellos and the fat-free salad dressing. There's just a lot of foods that have been created based on the calorie framework that are ultra-processed to appeal to people that are susceptible to dieting, that are very much filled with artificial sweeteners, colors, and a lot of things that don't actually support health. And so a stand that I've taken against ultra-processed foods is also a stand against diet culture, against foods that have really been marketed to vulnerable populations as being health promoting. They're able to put this health halo on it and say things like low calorie, fat free. Ultra-processed foods to me carries energy of deceit or corporate greed. And I think that that's also worth saying out loud, that the efforts toward challenging ultra-processed foods isn't challenging people. It's not challenging someone that's on a limited budget. It is challenging the system that makes these foods so cheap that other food purveyors can't compete. I think that's the public health part of the picture. My interest in ultra-processed foods really skyrocketed during my PhD in public health when thinking about the food environment, areas where these are made so accessible, reduce negative affect, and make it so that it becomes the norm. More than half of the calories consumed in the U.S. are ultra-processed foods. I like some of these foods. I've given up on biohacking and trying to optimize my health. You do it for 10 years and then you're like, I just want to live my life. I'm not against them for people. I do have bones to pick with ultra-processed foods in the context of thinking about food as an unspoken tool of oppression for marginalized groups.
I feel like we're not talking about that enough. To bring it back to our listeners, let's say you're like, oh my gosh, ultra-processed foods are terrible. How do you start with your patients? Because I'm not hearing that you're like, never eat any. That doesn't seem to be your approach.
In my patient care, I don't take that sort of authoritative approach on really anything. I think that most people are aware of what healthy eating looks like. There are people that don't have access to that information, of course, but most people want to talk through all the challenges and receive some psychoeducation and bounce ideas and get a feeling of being understood. And so if someone has a strong connection to ultra-processed foods, my role is to help them figure out what their values are. Some people value convenience and other people value eating in social settings. there's going to be someone else who values spending a good percentage of their money at the best grocery store and making their own food. So I like having conversations with people, and I call this value-based eating. What are your own personal values, and how does it fit into the context of your life? And from there, we can start to build steps moving forward.
Fuel your day with Orgain's organic plant-based protein powder. With 21 grams of smooth plant-based protein and no added sugar, it's a delicious way to support your goals, whether you're blending up a morning smoothie or adding a boost to your baking. It's certified organic, vegan, gluten-free, and crafted without any artificial ingredients, just clean goodness in every scoop. Another thing that I hear out there a lot right now is added sugar. And I'm interested in added sugar consumption related to depression, mental health, anxiety, even ADD. Can you unpack the conversation about added sugar and mental health?
Yes. While there are exceptions, a lot of mental health conditions are related to the gut environment, which is related to fiber intake. So I think of added refined sugars as strongly correlating with low fiber. When you think about what is added refined sugars, it's glucose, fructose that's generally been extracted from sources that originally had fibers in it. So when you are consuming refined sugars, you're generally not getting the fiber that's supposed to go along with it. Coming back to the addiction conversation, if you think about the drugs that people tend to misuse, if you think about how they occur in nature, like coca is a plant, people found a way to process it to remove all the fibers. And then there's a couple additional refinement steps to get something that's highly addictive. And I guess what I'm trying to say is coca plant's not highly addictive, but cocaine is. Sugar in its refined state in high amounts in the diet usually means that a person isn't getting enough fiber. So one could double click on the inflammatory nature of refined sugars, but I would also emphasize the inflammatory nature of low fiber. And that if someone got 30 to 40 grams of fiber per day and they had some added sugars in their diet, that would be very different than the person who had a lot of added refined sugars in the context of 10 or 12 grams of fiber per day.
It's such a great point. I feel like fiber is one of our big takeaways here.
I've told people I'm not into counting calories, but if there's one thing that you should count, count your fiber and really try to get those 10 grams per meal. Try to get 30 grams a day. Sometimes people can go even higher, and it's not something that needs to be consistent every day. You might have a lower fiber day or a higher fiber day, but I do believe in the context of gut health, brain health, and mental health, that that is one of the more important levers that gets overlooked.
Let's say that somebody wants to decrease added sugar, increase fiber, but they find that to be triggering. Maybe triggering restriction, shame, fear. Maybe they're in recovery from disordered eating or other addictions. What do you do with that?
I would encourage someone not to do something that was triggering. If someone has a long history of restricting ultra-processed foods and they come to me, we're going to just focus on meal timing strategies and making sure that the food covers a lot of these other bases. And if someone eats foods that are fun foods, as we sometimes call, that'll get celebrated. Everyone's relationship with food is not only different, but it's dynamic and it evolves over the lifespan. And I try to invite people to consider that what felt super true at age 22 might not be completely tracking with you at age 45. I think people really appreciate the open-mindedness to that approach.
You did mention something that I wanted to revisit briefly, which is trauma-informed care and a trauma-informed approach. I think that shows up more in mental health therapy, but I'm hearing that you use it.
There's a lot of trainings that have emerged in the last few years, which help people understand what it's like to live with the complexities of PTSD or complex trauma. But the best way to really be trauma-informed is to spend a lot of time with people that are in recovery and to be able to develop a clinical intuition. But in terms of general guidelines, it's probably safe to say that the top of the list with folks that are in recovery or have lived experience with trauma is to not be re-traumatizing, which means move with a gentleness and a sensitivity, to not make assumptions that if something's hard for them, it's because they're not motivated or they're not compliant. It's to assume that the barriers that exist are deep and that people are doing the best that they can with what they got in their current scenario. Trauma-informed also, to me, is a deep dive into the biology. And then also just thinking about the link between trauma and cognitive rigidity and impulsivity, being able to understand how people move through the world and using storytelling and connection as a real bridge toward recovery rather than a biomedical intervention.
I did want to end on one thing that you hope listeners can carry forward from our conversation today as they reflect on their own eating habits and their personal history.
Personal history is super important. We all have a story and we should use it to inform our current life and to look forward, but don't get too attached to any fact of yesteryear. Don't get too attached to a body of yesteryear. There's a lot of new information coming. There's a new consciousness around food. There's a heightened awareness and an interest in different ways of approaching this and different frameworks. If we come together, we can change the paradigm. Providers talking differently and people seeking help for different reasons. I'm a big believer in healthcare revolution.
Yeah, I think you're leading it in a lot of ways.
Thank you.
What an incredible conversation with Dr. Wiss. We dove into some tough but important topics around ultra-processed foods, the calorie model, and how nutrition can truly support our mental health. What I was reminded of in this conversation is the importance of personalizing nutrition care and understanding that healing often starts with listening to your body, stories, and needs. Seeking support from experts like Dr. Wiss and his team can be transformative. I'm so glad he's doing this amazing work. If you enjoyed today's episode, please follow, rate, and share the Good Clean Nutrition podcast. We'd love to hear what resonated most with you today.